Network Automation Nerds Podcast. Hello and welcome to Network Automation Nerds Podcast, a podcast about network automation, network engineering, Python, and a whole lot of technology topics. I am your host, Eric Choke. Network automation is a very hot topic in network engineering today. But if we hop on the time machine and go back for a few years, network automation was often looked at as the fad and something that would just go away if we waited long enough and the hype curve would just pass. But that all started to change when Jason Edelman started to preach the gospels of network automation in all the major networking conferences or conferences in general. He started to conduct training on O'Reilly Media, co-author his O'Reilly book, and eventually founded a very successful startup, Network to Code. So I'm super excited to be talking to Jason today about his personal path, his vision for the company, and in general, what he sees as the direction of the whole industry. So let's dive right in. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Eric. Really appreciate it.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. You know, I had previous guests on and they all mentioned Network to Code at one point or another. So I'm happy to finally have you on the show. I remember when I started this podcast, I appreciate all of my guests and they're all VIPs, but there's like a very selective list that I say, okay, I got it. Like whatever I do, you know, call, you know, beg or whatever, bribe somebody and I need to get them on the show. You're on that list. So I'm super glad you're here and, let's dive right in. Sure. But before we get started, right, like I'm always interested in people's background story, how they get into technology, how they get into network engineering. So, I mean, we've talked before, but I like to hear again, you know, your origin story. So please tell me, tell us how you get into technology. What got you interested?
Yeah, cool. This is a story probably that I've never, you know, I've never said or probably haven't even, you know, thought about in a while. But I would say if I go back to the origins, it's probably when I was in, I think I might've been in sixth or seventh grade.
Okay.
And you know, my grandparents had bought my brother and I a, like an IBM, like PS2 or something, 386 computer. Right. They have a two family house. And I think the upstairs, you know, the upstairs tenant, I think there was a boy that became friends with, and his father was in the computer business. And I think he was like building computers or something like that. And then I think for Christmas, we got a computer, and I would say, you know, the rest is somewhat history. But if I kind of try to break it down, you know, in the beginning we had, I think we got Prodigy as a dial up ISP.
Oh, okay. And
yeah. It was back then, you know, I forget, we would dial up and try to look at maybe, you know, sports scores or I don't know, try to figure out like what we can go find
the size that you could disclose. But as a young boy, you know, probably, you know, I don't know, something else, but, but that's cool. I remember Prodigy. I remember like AOL. Remember those discs that they mail it to you unsolicited? It'll be like 10 discs a month. And you were just like, oh, you know, please, I don't want that 500 free hours of internet. Just leave me alone.
Yeah, exactly. I had a computer. I even got, for a period of time, I was using like Paintbrush a lot. You know, it's just sort of, it was sort of like doing like artistic things, like trying to just really understands like what a computer can do. I remember just sitting there probably for hours, like clicking every button, right? I'm sure we all did.
Yeah.
Click start, click every arrow, try to look at every application that was installed and just try to understand, you know, what it all did. I would say like fast forwarding a little bit, probably when I really got more interested in it, when I was in 10th grade, this was probably 2-3 years later, the high school started offering more and more computer classes. And so there was that year they did, it was the same class, the first 6 months of the year, the first half of the year, they actually taught programming on a calculator. It was the old TI-82 calculator.
Those graphic calculators, right?
Yeah, exactly. First half of the year was programming on a calculator. Second half of the year was programming in, I think in Pascal. You had Pascal for
Oh, really?
For a few months. And then the next year, QBasic
was very popular, but it's Pascal for you then.
Yeah, back then Pascal sure. The next year, and then that was junior year, and senior year had some C++. But the calculator, I guess, was sort of how I kind of started dabbling in programming constructs anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Those snake games, right? Like, you remember the snake eating and just kind of go around and around. But I think it may have come out next year, but those TI calculators, there's actually going to have Python as a programming backend. It was very exciting. I mean, I read about it in Real Python and kind of forwarded on to anybody who would listen. They didn't know why I was so excited, but like I saw those calculators. How fitting is it to switch to Python and then program like a snake to go around the screen? And my daughter would never understand.
Yeah, I forget what games we might have done. Like back then, we had sort of algebra and stuff, and was trying to program like the quadratic formula and trying to you're learning math at the same time, learning programming at the same time. So it was almost it was just great as a kid trying to learn these things. So
yeah. For sure. So did you study computer? It's like, so that was 10th grade, right? So eventually you got some exposures in college, in high school. Did you end up studying computers in college?
No. It was interesting. So I had a little bit in 10th grade, 11th and 12th. Did have full years in high school.
Yeah.
And then I had one programming class my first semester of college, and that was it. And I was relieved. There was something about it where in high school I really did enjoy it. But maybe it was just like the pace of that first semester, and it wasn't a high touch model. It was just, hey, in class, in the lecture, here, go learn this. For homework, go do this. And I just felt really disconnected. Yeah. And in college, I majored in computer engineering, which
you did. Okay.
Yeah. Which again, to this day, really, I probably would have preferred computer science. Like, look, in hindsight, in terms of like having skills learned in college that actually could have been applied to, to a day job.
Yeah.
But otherwise, had some hardware classes along the way and general engineering classes. But otherwise, I don't remember too many of those computer-related classes that I.
You had such a great time in college that you start forgetting these courses that you took.
Yeah. Well, the truth is, even looking back then, the story that I love, and again, haven't thought about it in a while, when I was my second year in college, had my first semester, went home for Christmas break. When I went back to school in January, my neighbor, a couple feet down, I lived in this house. So like same floor. Came back with the Todd Lamley Slidebeck study guide, CCNA study guide.
Oh, okay.
He's like, nice. Oh man. He's like, over a break, I read this book. You got to check it out. And I was like, I had never heard of Cisco or networking. And I said, you know what? I don't know what part of me, second year in school, I was reading like a non-school book. Right. And I picked it up. I started reading, and it was so strange. I couldn't stop reading it. And I got to the point where I really felt like I was absorbing like every word in every page. And I almost could remember like the exact page I read about spanning tree or routing protocol, or whatever it was. And that was sort of my the dive really into networking. And from there, it was just obsessed with, every book, CCNA, Cisco Press. I was actually reading Cisco Press, CCNA's Cyber Study Guide simultaneously because I didn't want to feel like I was only getting shortchange reading like the study guide, like versus getting like the long form Cisco book. So yeah, it was great times back then. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So, first thing was like, so there's actually a computer engineering versus computer programming, different majors. So those are different. I mean, from an outsider, I would think they're the same, but I guess it was more about hardware and that kind of fits you into, computer networking. My guess is there's no dedicated, network engineering major at your school, but the closest thing would have been computer engineering. So you kind of dive right in from there.
Yeah, exactly. At one point they created some, networking classes. You know, there was, you know, the book by, I think, like Doug Comair. It was like TCP/IP book. You know, we had that, but it was very theoretical. Yeah, there might have been some electives to do at computer science, but to be on my third or fourth year in college, I was pretty like anti-computer science, and maybe like many network professionals, by then I had, I was at the time a teenager. I'd passed a CCNA, and look, I was just obsessed with Cisco networking, and I just wanted to learn more. I had gotten internships while I was still in school, where I just was so hungry. While I was still in school, I was doing cutovers and doing, installations, like mostly Nortel back then, like where I worked. It was Nortel base stack switches or Passport 8000 series switches, and so I was like reading Cisco, doing Nortel at the time. But luckily, right, I worked somewhere where there was only one networking person. They were sort of like mid career. And they had no problems giving me all the legwork, and so I had really no thought to ever want to program again that one semester in college in freshman year. Yeah. Like for me, it was networking straight on.
So you. Yeah. So they're saying, hey, you want to go punch down some wires? Go for it. Like, yeah, go configure that router. But you eventually went as far as, even though you were doing Nortel, you've went as far as getting your CCIE, right? So how many years after, I guess, you got your NA was IE?
Yeah, so I got my CCNA in like 2001, maybe.
Yeah.
Somewhere, it might've been 2000.
Yeah.
I'd have to slow down for a few seconds and stop talking and really think.
But, no problem. But, it was 20 years ago, so I'll forgive you.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine that. But yeah, the pack up here, the CCIE was 2005.
Oh, nice.
So it kind of worked out. Right? I had gotten a CCNA, CCNP, and then got a job at Cisco. And
oh, okay.
You might have heard of it. I got a job in their ASU program. Or CSAP is the umbrella. It was a sales associate program. I was an associate SE down RTP for, almost a year. And yeah, it just lucked out. I was able to give them the opportunity to, while I was down there.
Yeah.
I was given a few weeks to study for my day job. And so I just, studied, I don't know, 15 hours a day. That whole year was training, but it involved more than tech training. It was like sales training, role play training, Prezo training, and a bunch of things like that. But towards the end, so I passed. It was November of 2005. I think starting after Labor Day that September, I think I took like 6 to 8 weeks, and I just went all in, and probably 15-hour days, and studying, and knock on wood, just was fortunate enough to, pass on the first time. Just because I say that because the day job was studying, and it kind of worked out where I didn't have to necessarily do the before and after work studying, right, like many people have done. So, yeah.
That's cool. I mean, I remember the ASC program very vividly because I applied and did not get in. So, you're much cooler than me.
No, I have referrals. No, look, I didn't forget this actually. So where I worked, my SE had brought it up to me. I was like, oh, I never heard of it. And then, I do think and he had just came out of the program.
Right.
So, and he knew, he knew one of the instructors. So maybe he, a friend of a friend of a friend's, maybe. That's how I got in. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten in either.
Yeah. It's always who now in business, right? 100%. Rather than, Well, it's both, but it helps to know somebody who graduated a program and knows the ins and outs. But so cool, man. So you went ahead and did all the networking. You were at Cisco, so it's 100% networking all the time. Got your IE, does pure networking. But something changed, right? Something changed along the way that you started to think about network automation. You were, and eventually found Network to Code. So How did that transition happen?
Okay, so yeah, I joined Cisco. I was there several years. I left Cisco. I went into the VAR space for a couple of years. But by and large, it was very similar. Yeah, I was doing, and even in that space, by and large, I was doing technical sales, you know, for my day to day. Yeah. So after the CCIE, I wasn't, that was 2005, I just said.
Yeah.
And then I joined the VAR space, and then I ended up starting Network Code in 2014. Like, no joke, for that period of time, I wasn't hands-on very much at all. Again, being technical, you know, you still read a lot of things and config guides and kind of, you know, put yourself into the shoes of an operator. Yeah. But wasn't really hands-on. And like any SEU would tell you, they always, myself included, always feel like, hey, if I had more hands-on, I could sell more or sell better and this and that. But it got to the point where, like, around the time of 2011 was sort of when I kind of got obsessed with OpenFlow and SDN. I told the story a couple times where, I was obsessed OpenFlow was going to change the world overnight.
Yeah.
And then I started a personal blog in 2011 and started speaking at conferences. And again, just became really obsessed with SDN, or I should say with what became SDN along the way. And it wasn't until I was working at Presidio. It was a large integrated, large VAR in 2013. They announced Cisco 1PK, which was the first SDK to program against Cisco router or switch. And they had Java, C, and Python bindings to be able to program against a device. And I remember being in the room, with some managers, and they said, are you going to do that? Being like this SDN guy, do you want to go learn how to do that? In my head, I was like, how am I going to program or code against a networking device? At this point, my freshman year of college was September of essentially 99, 2000. I was like, it's been years. Yeah. I don't even know how to even know where to begin.
Right.
So that story is I ended up going to where I graduated from college. I ended up finding like an 18-year-old kid and said, hey, I'll pay you a few bucks an hour out of pocket to teach me how to program maybe again. And I'll teach, if you want, I'll give you career advice. They didn't want any career advice. They just wanted, they just wanted some, work study money. And
right.
We met in the library, once or twice a week, a couple hours at a clip. And it was like, for me, when I learned something new, like having somebody that I can ask like the dumb questions to really helps. So we met for a few weeks and that's all I needed. And then I got into a Cisco 1PK and also had somebody at Cisco, had like a partner SE who helped answer questions on Cisco side. And, then from there, it was just sort of laser focus moving forward. Along the same time, I had some demos of Ansible as well. And I think for Ansible for me, it was like the big aha moment because I was developing things with 1PK and then being customer facing, I was trying to give demos to customers. And I remember the one customer that we were in, they dimmed the lights to see the projector. So I'll never know, was it the lights or was it me or was it maybe code? It was like, the guy, he was dozing off. And so I was like you never want to see that. And it happens after lunch, it happens.
Yeah, sure.
But it almost was so obvious at the time. I was trying to do a demo of a Python library. And same period of time, I saw Ansible. I was like, there's definitely something here and a reason why, platforms like this exist. Again, the Shafts, the Puppets, the Ansibles. And like it was just too low level. And realizing that was sort of like the catalyst to say, I spent years doing technical sales, high-fiving on some of these large deals and like not really caring about how are my customers going to absorb this technology? How are they going to manage it day to day? Mm-hmm. And like that was really the catalyst for me, is sort of, you know what, I really want to be able to, I want to have like an impact on the day-to-day of the network engineer and network operations. And that was the general thought process to go leave and start Network to Code.
Wow, that's very interesting. I mean, I too remember the 2011 timeframe that OpenFlow came about. I think it was OpenFlow 1.0, maybe 1.1. You know, Nicira was still in stealth, and you know, Big Switch was out there. They're probably the only game in town. I remember going to the second, I think it was called OpenFlow Symposium or whatever, on the campus of Stanford. I don't know if you were there.
Okay, no, I went. No, that was I didn't make that one. No.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, you know what I was talking about. It was like a small gathering. And because I think because of the few people at Microsoft that at the time was friends with those guys. And so we just kind of hatched the ride. And I didn't understand half of the stuff I was doing or looking at, but I was nervous as you were, or, you know, like having this nervous energy about how this was going to change the world, right? You mean like they could have this abstraction and northbound interface, and they don't have to touch any of the network devices, and network devices talk to the controller and all that. So I remember that time period very vividly, but that never worked out the way it did, right? I mean, it changed a lot of things, changed people's mindset, but it never went out the way that OpenFlow was designed to do, and all of these startups end up pivoting to other areas.
Yeah, no, look, agreed. I still give credit to all of that work. I think we're not speaking about this today if that didn't happen. And yeah, you know, I've often said, you know, maybe somewhat thankfully that the industry got like very caught up in protocols and overlays, and even competing overlays from Nicira had their own, then VXLAN, then just Genevieve as a third. Like there was so much protocol talk. I think then you started to kind of look at the real problem around network management and like the management plane itself versus like the control and data plane.
Right.
That being said, I think all of that work definitely led to the notion of having controllers, improving operations, thinking about things as systems. And the truth is, and even with where our focus is now, like my day to day thinking about network automation, and even having controllers helps operations, but it doesn't solve itself like workflow problems or workflow challenges that you have in day-to-day operations. But yeah, that time for me, I loved that time. I remember checking Nicira's website like every day, like when are they leaving stealth? And on Twitter, if there was an article that mentioned anything about OpenFlow SDN protocols, it was like read it 3 seconds later, I was blogging about it like that night. It was just, it was really fun times. I really did enjoy it.
Yeah. You were stalking Mark Martin in every step that he took. Like, oh my God, you know, what happened? And then all of a sudden, like, I don't know, 1 week after stealth, they got acquired, right? So you're like, oh.
Yeah. Cool. And then you hear the stories, you know, then you kind of imagine, you know, VMware paid like $1.2 billion.
Yes.
And supposedly outbid Cisco. Like, what would have happened if Cisco or somebody else would have acquired them? But
I don't know. It would be very different, right? Very different. But I think previously you mentioned, okay, you want to be more involved on the day to day. You want to essentially bridge the gap between traditional networking to, you know, what we know networking as now. But I remember you spoke at O'Reilly, was it Velocity? And you also published even before the book, the O'Reilly book, you published book reports on either Ansible or just network automation. So was that before or after you founded Network to Code?
The first thing, yeah, it was an O'Reilly white paper. Mm-hmm. And that might have been on Ansible for network automation. It was after. And
okay.
I would say, so I started the business in 2014. Mm-hmm. The white paper, I actually think the white paper might have been after even signing to write the book, but yeah, you know, they were starting to see, you know, the interest in network automation. So they want to kind of insert the white paper, and luckily the business was still small. It didn't, you know, was able to peel away some time, some hours in the day and the night to do that. But yeah, I think that was might have been 2015, the white paper, maybe something like that. And that was like the first thing via, via O'Reilly.
Okay. Cause that was, I remember reading your book or white paper. I think it was the way I remember it was one of those book reports from O'Reilly. So like the white paper is this own thing, but there's like thin, less than 100 page book report from O'Reilly. I remember really excited, at the same time, really nervous and say, oh, somebody already did this, right? So I wanted to do something like that, but somebody already did this. Who's this guy? Who's this Jason Edmund guy who got that bid? But it was very exciting. And then I went on, I saw your talk at various conferences. In particular, you were traveling around. It seems like you were traveling around to different conferences just to legitimize this, right? Because that was at the time you mentioned 1PK, and 1PK had a lot of hype, but it never went anywhere. And so people were treating network automation as on the same trajectory and say, well, who knows, and we'll just have to wait it out and all of that. But you were doing a lot of talks. Was it part of your strategy to gain a lot of visibility? Like, you need to validate this idea of the company that you basically founded on.
No, I think the 1PK, I might have, I'm trying to think, one of the first talks that I might have given on this, it might have been Interop. Interop used to be in New York as well.
Okay.
I think October, I started the business actually August of 14. And I gave a talk October of 14 at Interop in New York.
Yeah.
I don't think Vegas was after that, I believe. So I think that might have been the first time that I gave like a public presentation on it. Mm-hmm. Before that, there might have been definitely, a good amount of blogs, but I don't think there was any other like public presentations per se. But no, like to me, like it, like for me, it was never like there was ever any intent, and I say this like looking back at it like naively, like there wasn't there wasn't intent to build a brand per se. Like there wasn't there wasn't any other intent, right? Even for marketing or to it was literally, I would say, like to this day, it was always like as an outlet. Like I had already left, but even in my day job, like there was nobody I can communicate with about any of this stuff. Like even going back to 2011, I remember bringing up like some of these things, even when I was leaving, my job, when I was like demoing 1PK, demoing Ansible, the questions that I was asked about were about ACI and NSX. And I was just like, I couldn't understand that. So I just like, for me, like the speaking at conferences or writing, or at the time, even creating like this, Slack workspace, the current network workspace in 2015, all of these things for me, it was just to like have an outlet. And it was great because like virtually through the world, then you were meeting these like-minded individuals that were like thinking about the same things. And like, that to me was so fun. So it was like that itself became like a snowball effect, because you were just meeting more people. And at the time, like there was guys like, Kurt Byers and David Brasso, Matt Oswald, and some of these guys, back then. It was just so amazing to talk to those guys.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, definitely. I think I remember that time period as well, where we're just, I feel so alone, right? Because I was in a big company and they believe in software driven networking, but they don't believe in, but there were still a lot of gaps between us, like, whether that's Python, whether that's open source, whether that's just the ideology wise, they could tolerate up to a certain point. But at some point, I feel like we're just not speaking the same language, no pun intended, but we were not. So it was cool to hear you talk and also, just to see like-minded people, like you said. And kind of for me, it validates and say it's worth exploring opportunity outside, because there are people, I mean, there are pockets of people who believe in what I believed in, even though at the time all the major vendors were not hopping on this train just yet.
Yeah, exactly. And where you were you able to even dabble in some of the open source projects, or was it a lot of custom built and in-house things?
Yeah. It was a lot of custom built, and it was so it was Microsoft, right? So like I've talked about this before. So at Microsoft, you know, we're certainly doing a lot of software driven development, and back to, you know, what we're talking about for you know, OpenFlow, SDN, the original, you know, Open Daylight, that type of stuff. But it was during a time of consolidation. So they were allowing me, for example, and some of the other people to choose whatever language they could choose while they focus on the core of what they're trying to develop. But eventually, as long as it works, right? And then there's different iterations of data centers, the different iterations of architecture, but eventually those need to be pulled in line to the main branch, if you will, right? So they were allowing people to choose whatever language to whatever way they do as they see fit. But eventually, you know, after they get the core done, after they get all the low-hanging fruit, they need to pull people in. And that is when I personally had to make a decision whether I would conform to, you know, C# and all the in-house code to contribute to, or I want to, you know, leave and continue my Python path and all the other stuff that I feel passionate about. So that was, you know, kind of my story, but this is not about me. This is about Network to Code and
stop that.
And your path. But I mean, it was I'm always been interested, and we talked before, but we never talked about like your origin story. So it's it's very fun to listen to and find a parallel and similarities between us, our own paths, because we kind of went through that same period, right? Like, and we were all traditional network engineer and looking at this new thing and wondering where it was going to go.
Yeah, exactly. Now looking back, it's been 10 years, and I just, you know, can't realize and how fast that it's gone. And now when, you know, talk about the business and where we're going, like we just really have to recognize the industry moves at a glacier pace sometimes. And that's helpful if you can recognize that, because you can strategize, build some ideas now and take time to execute on it versus, you know, trying to move too quick. So.
Yeah. So how do you balance between that, right? Moving too quick, because obviously when you first started, you talked about there was an outlet for you to speak. So there was no, you know, kind of branding or marketing to begin with. So how did Network to Code start from this one person team all the way to, you know, where it is today, where it's winning awards and it's, you know, growing and getting more funding and so on?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say from starting the business, the very early years, you know, I think it's so important to, and again, this is even looking back, it just worked out. So if this is advice for those who are, you know, thinking about do something similar too. But I would say customer number one ended up, it was a manufacturer, and which was good. And it was helping them build some internal training.
Yeah.
And customer, I should say projects 2 through 6 were also selling to manufacturers to help build them things like Ansible integrations, Ansible modules, and then Python libraries as an example. And so there was like a period, the first 12 months, it might have been selling to, I think three or four manufacturers. Aside from like the very first sale, it was all around like Python and Ansible development, and really making sure like they, you know, I was again really trying to sell them on what I was seeing around. It was really taken somewhat of a bet on Ansible back then, because at the time, like, they didn't even have any Ansible modules themselves. Arista had a pocket of modules. Juniper did. And Network to Code, we built a handful at the time, though. Again, we're, three people. And I say this kind of worked out, because selling to the manufacturers early on was great, because it's not like you were doing production things. Like, you know, you didn't necessarily need that added insurance or 24/7 support or anything like that. It was just, you know, projects were being built to essentially help build, you know, community without knowing it. Again, still for me, it was just like the belief, like trying to talk to a vendor on the phone. It was, you know, I talked to several others that couldn't fathom that, you know, some didn't want to do this. It was like, can you not see where the industry is going? This just makes a ton of sense. But that being said, it kind of worked out in that, you know, manufacturers, large ones, you know, definitely have, you know, a fair amount of money to spend. And so this was still a newer thing. And so it was hard to gauge anyway how much time it was going to take. But I think it kind of worked out where, you know, that became, you know, the first several months plus of effort. And you know, that sort of like funded the first person and the second person. Some early on were contractors. And then so, you know, went down that path for probably a good 18 months. And at that time, like we were publishing more software, using more software than Napalm's and then at Miko's, still continuing to build the brand. And I say that now, but at the time it wasn't trying to build the brand. It was like literally trying to just speak and showcase what was possible to really drive the industry. And again, but more and more requests came in. I would say in 2015, you know, it actually was after the first year of the business, then we started to do our own training. Right. You know, we had some in the second half of 2015, it was great. Then started traveling, right. Going to Europe, doing training in Europe, private training and so on. And like that going to 2016, then I was traveling probably, you know, 2-3 times a month, let's say, actually, you know, private courses, you know, we're doing public courses in New York, San Jose, Dublin, London, you know, going all over. But I would say you kind of knew it was building up. And then we started getting requests for services, right? Can you help us, you know, can you actually help us deploy this and start automating our networks? And then I knew we were going to, you know, need people to help do that. And then, so ironically, I crossed paths with Ken Salenza, who is now at Network Decode. He's been here five and a half years almost. And he took a big risk. You know, he had a full-time job for almost a decade at one employer, you know, doing great things in networking. And he joined in May of 2016, and it just turned out he was doing amazing things right away, and he helped really, you know, grow that practice and that business on the services side. And it's ironic telling this story, probably haven't said it publicly, but we met at a mutual friend's bachelor party, ironically enough. And this story could probably relate to. So we were both there. There's open laptop that had things around like BYOD or, you know, other products, and asking around, I was like, whose laptop is that? You know, just because, you know, it's mentioning products. And then, you know, it turned out it was Ken's, and they were like, oh, you know, what do you do for a living? What do you do? And it's like, oh, network engineer. Oh, same here.
Oh, okay.
And we both thought there's no way he's a network engineer, because like you never meet a network engineer. You usually meet somebody who does some administrative
developers, you know,
or admins, or maybe maybe they're doing some like SMB work, doing some, you know, just like small scale work where you're doing some Microsoft work, like maybe like Cisco work, some, like, you know, things like that. And it's like, no, like we were going toe to toe for a while. Then he started bringing up MPLS design. So I'm like, "Are you got me? Like, you got me. You're going too deep for me right now.
You're legit, man, but you're going too deep.
Yeah, you're a real network engineer, basically.
And
so then we kept in touch after the party. And then really within a few months, you know, had him sold on the opportunity. And ironically, I was hiring Ken for his experience in network operations. Right. It wasn't even for automation. And so it wasn't until after he was hired that I realized he had a great background for, you know, what he might say is scripting or being a script kiddie. But he, you know, he was automating for almost his whole time at his he was at McKinsey for a while. He was automating his whole time there in Perl and just SourceForge, downloading things and using them. So it just turned out he already got like APIs and so forth. And it was just, you know, it was like pivoting to Ansible and Python and so on. But yeah, so from there on out, it was just a snowball effect. You know, he was effectively employee number one. And then again, there'd be just more work in the community, more requests would come in. And, you know, then we very quickly brought on, you know, three, four, and five.
Yep.
And, you know, we even brought on interns along the way. And, you know, one of them is still here, Jordan Facciabene. He started in 2017, maybe. And so we just continued to grow, and it was just like the interest. Like I would say, I look at it now, like tell the story of like NTC 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0.
Yep.
And so like we were running around, like, we were flying around, going all over. And luckily we were able to both do that in our lives at the time. And then probably in 2017, it was probably like October, November, we were already like giving SOWs out the door, proposals out the door, where we were going to do, we already had like line of sight to do more business in the first month or two of 18 than we did in all of 17. So I was like, you know what? We definitely probably need more help, and we got to hire more, and even on the business side. And that's when I talked to an old friend of mine, John Marchese, who came on board in January 18 as our CEO, because we had line of sight of this growth. And so John started as our CEO in January. So like 1.0, I always state is like pre 2018, pre John, we hired John, and then we hired like three or four guys immediately to fulfill project demand that we had. And then we just continued to grow. And we, from the start, all of our customers were like really, I say this just like still very humbled, but they were all like name brand companies, Fortune 500, Fortune 100 customers. And I say that because in my prior jobs, pre Network to Code, I would joke saying at the dinner table, my family wouldn't know any of my customers, just because, you know, there were, you know, mid-sized organizations, and that's the vast majority of companies out there anyway in the world. But everyone Network to Code, like they were all like name brand. And so, you know, we would just continue to look at these logos and these brands, and, you know, hiring John on board, we just started to, you know, maximize sort of the value that we can provide. And we just, you know, did that, you know, day after day, month over month, and continued to grow the business, you know, created the right offerings and the right value propositions to our customers. And then we started selling, you know, multi-month, multi-year projects and deals and we're still doing it today.
Nice. So I remember talking, so that was a transition for you as well, right? Because I remember talking to Ken, maybe like at an Ansible Fest or whatnot, and he was telling me the biggest challenge at the time was to tell the customer, or trying to communicate to the customer, that NTC was more than Jason Edelman. And so, you know, like you said, 1.0 is you guys were running around doing a lot of projects, and that was a lot of high touch, a lot of personal relationship, you know, being built. And now it seems like you transition into, you hire a business person, CEO, and you're delegating, you know, a good chunk of business operations to other folks. And of course, congratulations to Ken as well. He just recently won an award, got promotion, and all of that. So congratulations to Ken. But at the same time, that was a transition for you, right? Like to going from 1.0 to 2.0, you're moving away from the day to day, but rather into more of a building your vision, building business process, and all of that.
Yeah, it was to a certain extent. But, you know, the truth is, even in that 2.0 phase, at least in 2018, I actually traveled more in 18 than I probably did any other single year at Network Code. And that's because I was still 2018. I was still personally doing a lot of training, a lot of speaking too, but a lot of training. I think I might have went to Australia like 3 or 4 times in like a 2 month
period. God, yeah,
and then Singapore and different countries. And again, luckily, I was single and loved it. Like it was actually 18. No, I was dating my wife, so I can't say I was single, but still wasn't married yet.
Is she listening?
but it was still great. But so in essence, I was still doing a lot of that. At the same time, was still very much focused on how do we continue to grow the business. It was but again, having John, having a CEO, you know, for sure allowed us to do that, allowed us to still fulfill the business while we had, you know, the proper focus on business operations, everything, lots of contracts and legal and finance and planning and budgets. And there was a lot of things that we were just getting by on. And, you know, we needed that focus.
Network to Code was, so obviously you mentioned there was a kind of a transition, but at the same time, you guys all work in a startup. So everybody does everything. So what does Network to Code, what are the revenue streams, I guess, or were the services or offerings that Network to Code offer today that you would consider your main, I guess, revenue source? How do you make money?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I would say, you know, we can look at it, you know, at a fairly high level. Is, yeah, I mentioned the two, you know, the two main components, you know, right now. I would say if we were to break it down, there would be a training component and professional services component. Those are the two components. We can kind of dissect them a little bit, because even on the training side, like from our perspective, training has really expanded quite a bit in the past couple of years, going from, you know, just a handful of classes to, you know, like as I mentioned, a lot of our customers are on the larger side, you know, so now like that's expanded to what we refer to as training and enablement. And it's really creating and crafting the right enablement programs for our customers. And so, you know, our goal is to have, you know, a lot more touch points to make sure they're understanding the material, as an example. So if you attend like a 3-day or a 5-day, like again, it's great, but you know, it's breaking that down and having the right offering. Think about it as like a college curriculum or like a syllabus to be able to have different types of training. You know, maybe some of it is in person, some of it is on demand. Maybe there's labs here, slides here, right? So I would say that part of the business is still very much focused on enablement. Mm-hmm. And the services piece has, you know, a variety of things, you know, typical in the services business, but, you know, there might be fixed cost projects, you know, that are tight in scope, or there might be, you know, the larger ones that are, that might be more time-based, as an example. And then I would say for on the larger side, you know, we have, you know, what we refer to as our transformational services, where, you know, if it is that customer who's bought into the vision and they understand themselves that it is no doubt going to be a multi-year journey with or without us, right? I think like that's first and foremost in the industry. Like there's still, like it's so easy to do a demo that it's deceiving on like the real work effort to transform a team or a department or an organization. So I would say when for the larger ones, our transformational services are, you know, for those clients who really buy into it, you know, then we would craft, you know, the right amount of enablement, the right amount of services, and the right team. Like it could actually be several people dedicated to a single client to help them transform their organization.
Was there any, I guess, products that you guys thought about? But so right now, you know, if I'm hearing this correctly, it's the training, it's, you know, professional services that could be shorter term or like one-time engagement, or that could be multi-year deals. But was there any time that you thought about doing a product and you just passed on the opportunity for whatever reason?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. You know, we do a lot in the open source software space right now, and really always have, you know, pockets of things over the years from Ansible modules, Python libraries, and so forth. I would say in 2016 or 17, like there might have been a general thought.
Yeah.
The thought probably was never a pivot, but there was, I worked at Cisco for a couple of years, and I spent time at a services company. So for me, like the idea to be consultative and to be able to solve problems through services was always so attractive, because, and I say this and I mean it, like you can really help your customers, right? Whatever it takes, you can help them figure out a way to get there, ideally the most optimal way. And so I would say, at one point we did a demo for a sales prospect on something that we were experimenting with. And every question was about like what we were demoing. It was like, can it do that? Can it do that? And I was like, that's not like really, that's not who we are as a business. Our business is about helping you solve problems, you know, with or without this widget. You know, if this can is the widget, you know, yes, this can be blue, but like maybe you need blue liquid in this plastic. You know, that was a good transition.
You planted those, didn't you?
but in terms of that's sort of like questioning, well, maybe the liquid is the wrong thing or something like that. So I would say I love consultative services. I think being able to package the services right is sort of where we are now. And as we go forward, like we have plans for things like managed services, right? Sure. Cloud services to help productize services in the right consumable manner. And, you know, it's a productization of services, but it's still not necessarily like a product per se. So I would say it was definitely thought about it at times, but it never really went too far where we had to rethink, you know, business plans and so on.
Yeah, because you did as you mentioned, you were always in the open source community. So there was the NetBox that you guys, you know, start sponsoring, and eventually fork your own for more, I think, development that fits, you know, the direction that you see going. Obviously, you work with other product owners and companies like Terraform, SaltStack, Batfish, all of that. But I would just, you know, it's always interesting when or how do you determine that service was the offering? And it sounded like it was an extension of your own experience. It's like an extension of Jason from whatever years that he worked at Cisco and worked at VARs to extend those, as opposed to, you know, maybe if you came from a manufacturing or product background, then you would have built a product.
Yeah, 100%. 100% agree. I would say, yeah, it's well said. I lost my train of thought. I was gonna say on the consulting side. Yeah, I forgot what I was gonna say. But
no, that's okay. It'll come back to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys recently had a press release on.
Oh yeah, real quick. What I was gonna say is you mentioned our fork and Nautilbot, or you mentioned other projects that are ours. Like that's the thing. Even for us now, like our goal. And like my goal from the start in 2014 was to truly help transform the industry in network automation in any way possible. Mm-hmm. And even early on, as we sold to manufacturers, helped them build modules, we helped them build their own training that we didn't even own. Like it was their IP, and like that was fine. Like we were helping train their sales teams and their engineering teams. Then we had our own training. We had our own services, and so. You know, I feel like I'd love to even write a book on lessons learned and or the things you hear in the peanut gallery, you know, positive or negative from people over the years. People might even look at that as being somewhat like not related on who's your client. Is it the manufacturer or is it the customer? It's like, look, like truly, like the mission was to, you know, help transform the industry, you know, one network engineer at a time, right? And And you know, that was the goal, and it still is. And I say that because even with our own open source projects, we don't have to use them in our projects, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times our projects start with doing design reviews, analysis, and building roadmaps. If a client happens to be doing really well in a given area around orchestration or automation or source of truth, let's take advantage of that, right? You know, mm-hmm. Our goal is to help optimize. And we talked a lot about like time to value. Our goal is really to accelerate time to value. And, you know, we're not going to do that, you know, if we have to, you know, rip out certain things that are there. And so, I tried to make that point around sort of, you know, the vision really hasn't changed. And, you know, we want to be able to, you know, help accelerate, you know, that mission over the years.
How close do you think you're at that mission of help transform the network engineering? So obviously the industry has been it's very different from when you and I started, you know, looking at OpenFlow 1.0, for example, up until the now, where, you know, it's almost 100% agreeable about cloud, about open source, about some of these projects, and which direction the industry is going. So how far do you think you're away from the mission of transforming the industry one network engineer at a time?
It's still early. It's so early. And I say that in hindsight, again, you know, talk about the OpenFlow days 10 years ago.
Yes.
Look at where we are now. I still think we have another 7 to 10 years to put a really good dent. I think it'll accelerate. We've learned a lot over the years, but it's still so early. You know, if we look at based on number or percentages of adoption of automation or the quantity of network engineers that have started to explore like this new world, and that might be open source or not. Again, have nothing against commercial tooling, right? You know, it's companies have to make money, somehow, but I would say network engineers exploring like some way to do modern network automation, I think we're still low. I think the numbers in terms of, you know, global 2000, you know, if it's a baseball game, I'm wearing a, you know, Yankees hoodie. If it's a baseball, you know, if it's a Yankees game, maybe we're in the third inning. I think we have time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're in the third inning, but Network Dakota is batting like 0.4 or something like that, right?
So, about 400, maybe.
Yeah, 400.
Yeah. Look, I think like, we continue to learn. I think even where we are, where we're trying to go, I think the past couple of years, there's still a lot of skills development to happen. Yeah. And I think this has to, and I've always, even probably dating back the past several years, I remember in 2014, 2015, even talking about this, I think people have to evolve their skills. Again, you know, you've written a book too. And I think, you know, I think we have to be able to help people do that. But people and organizations have to be able to decouple like individual learning and personal paths from the organizational path at hand. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I know in our day to day, we talk a lot about things like power tools. You know, you bang out a quick script or a playbook or a job or, you know, Terraform, Ansible, Python, doesn't matter what it is. Like we could pip install Ansible or something like that, or not even just use, you know, Python and install a request and make an API call. You could do things right now within a few minutes. But if you really want to make a dent in sort of the enterprise-wide adoption, like that's when you get into the, you know, how do you strategize and build the right multi-year journey for that? So I would say, yeah, it's still early on. When you look at it per engineer, as a business, when we look at it, right, you know, if we're batting 400, yeah, you know, maybe, you know, that's obviously a good number in baseball.
It is.
So maybe I, you know, look, I always want to do better. Then we got to do better. Then we got to you know.
All right, you're going for that goal then. So you talked about multi-year strategize and, you know, separating your own personal, you know, scripting capability versus the enterprise or the whole company's goal. So can you give me an example of a multi-year strategy versus just some quick scripts that you bang out to help you do the day-to-day?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think we talk a lot about architecture. And I think we probably have interop presentations from our team that kind of talk through this way more than I have in recent years. But I would say this, I would say when we engage and we do have to make sure we're able to show value mm-hmm. to our customers in a reasonable amount of time. And I say that because we've had to even change the way we work to be able to do that. Meaning if we were to start a client engagement and it takes 12 months to build out like the, you know, the non-functional things, if it's getting the pipelines right, or if it's like even take an enterprise and you want to install a new server, mm-hmm. let's say you're going to buy a new tool, download a new tool. It could literally take 3 months to get that installed properly, vetted. You know, if it's a Linux team, systems team, network team, and next thing you know, then that server, it was going to host even your scripts. Mm-hmm. And then there's firewalls between, you know, the server and the devices. Still mm-hmm. can't even do anything. And, you know, we've seen this over the years. And so again, the questions, you know, that are asked, you know, early on are way better now than 5 years ago, right? To be able to make sure we're able to accelerate that time to value. So in terms of like breaking it down, I would say for us, we talk about those power tools or the quick wins and mm-hmm. and the multi-year approach that, you know, for us, it's that architectural vision, that architectural approach. And we'll talk about source of truth, talk about automation, talk about orchestration, talk about telemetry and closed loop systems, and really kind of go one pillar at a time. And so we'll see, how do we build that vision while understanding the power tools, because the power tools are really, they are important to mm-hmm. know what engineers are trying to do, because the engineers are so close to the problem at hand, like their day-to-day, their change windows. And for us, then we have to try to marry those two together. And when we do that for us, like one workflow at a time, because like you don't want to have one approach for firewalls, one approach for wireless, one approach for X or data center. And so we definitely do believe that there should be one cohesive strategy, you know, one engine, if you will, mm-hmm. that might be multiple tools and components, but you should be aware of everything happening versus deploying five tools, buying five tools that aren't integrated together at all. And so if you're doing this in a large enterprise, it takes time. And again, a lot of that time is process, no doubt, but even to agree on strategy. And a lot of them already have lots of tools deployed. And then so understanding how they're all going to integrate and play nice together, it, mm-hmm. You know, takes time.
Yeah, no, I like that. Right. So I think that's speaking from a true startup founder is you want to have that very, very short time to value. So you're showing that, you know, you're absolutely on the game, you could put out the fire if you need to be. But once that fire is put out, you pull back and say, let's look at the forest and not just these tools or the new hotness that you saw in the in-flight magazine. It's this whole cohesiveness. Let's look at what you already have tools wise, and let's look at what's available out there. And that's, you know, kind of have this multi-year strategy of where do we go from here, and here's step one, step two, until we get, you know, finally achieve what we want to achieve at the end. I like that. I think that's very important. It's even at your own job, right? You may not be, you know, NTC and you not be Jason Edelman. You're at your job, but you still want to follow the same pattern, right? You want to bring value immediately, but at the same time, you want to look around you and say, what's my strategy as a company of one, or what's my department strategy? What can I tell my boss on what we can do as a as a strategy to hang that goal, and then here are the steps that we go. I think that's something that I try to follow as well. So thanks for bringing that to an example.
Yeah, no, well said. And one more thing I'll add there is,
yeah,
especially for those that are in their company today, trying to convince maybe their team or manager this is the right path, and maybe they're in the lab trying to build a demo to showcase internally. And I would say with a lot of engineers, as they get started or even maybe on their journey, should be more okay with work that might not make it to production, or mm-hmm. it might not make it past 3 months because of a proper strategy. And so I definitely think it is important to be able to showcase value, to do the proof of value, proof of concept type things. And I say that because if you were to say, well, how long would it take you to automate X? Well, but you just watch this great YouTube video and this person, is automating X in an hour. But right. if you want to do it in an enterprise, like there's so many more things to consider. So I would say it's not a bad thing to showcase internally the quick win versus you spending 6 months, putting your, blood, sweat and tears into it. Then it goes nowhere. You kind of want to, document like where it should be and then mm-hmm. be able to do something early on to get buy-in and then mm-hmm. be okay if that does get thrown out, especially using agile, incremental, and approach and sprint over sprint. I think we got to get okay with being able to show the value and iterate on it and continue to make it better and better over time.
Yeah, I think that's the key, right? Because you want to have that minimal viable product, and that minimal viable product, viable meaning value. So you need to have this something, this thing to bring value, and then continue to iterate on it to make it better. And so on. I enjoy that approach very much. And I think that would be the most successful way forward, because you're essentially creating a positive loop where, you're spending some time, bring value, and then more credibility to you. So you get more time next time to spend maybe time away from work, the day to day to do the next, iteration of that minimum viable product.
Yeah, you got to think as the engineer or as a company, whoever's on the other side of the table, if it's your manager or a stakeholder, you got to be asking, what if they're asked to show value? How do they also, show value? So it's really important to kind of think about them and the other stakeholders in the room as well.
Yeah, I mean, If you ask me, I mean, I enjoy all of our conversation, but the last bit, I think that's the most valuable part. And the most valuable thing that our audience could take away from is, put yourself in another person's shoe, and how do you bring value immediately and also mid-range and long-term? I think that's very valuable.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed.
So I'm going to ask you an open-ended question, you could pick and choose however deep you want to go into. So where do you think network automation is going? And that definitely is right up your alley on something you've been thinking about, I bet.
Yeah. I think about network automation, network to code, sort of like what we're doing and how the industry is progressing. We work on all types of projects, right? Everything from open source integrations, custom integrations, commercial platforms, from top manufacturers as well. I would say, I was saying earlier, it's still fairly early on. Yeah, I feel like for us and what we've seen in the past 18, 24 months, it's been a pretty big shift to start thinking about data-driven automation, things like source of truth. Yeah, it's still early on to want to have your data drive automation versus fill out a form, click submit, and have the data go nowhere except the device. Then you haven't really, you're going a little faster, but you're not necessarily, putting a dent in the problem statement. So I think source of truth continues, if we were kind of plotted out in the next several years, source of truth is a big one right now. I do think if we were to look at it as a closed loop system, what's interesting is, there's the acronym from you know, we'll give Apstra credit around intent-based networking from when they emerged. So that's truthfully how we think about network automation. You know, we really don't use the intent-based terminology all that much, but we do think about it as a closed-loop system. You know, there's still like not a ton of focus around, you know, the telemetry observability. There's some manufacturers out there, you know, some open source projects that are starting to emerge. So I think that'll continue to grow. And once we, you know, have both of these spectrums, meaning automation to the device, collecting data from the device, I think we'll start to see like that bridge between them and the closed loop, the event driven, which again, I was a big fan of StackStorm over the past several years. And yeah, they might've been, you know, a bit early on the network side for sure, you know, when they were doing what they were doing. But I think the closed loop, the event driven systems will be good. Overall, what I would love to see, and we'll do our part to get there as well, is just more turnkey stacks, right?
Okay.
And you can look at like OpenStack or the LAMP stack or some of these stacks.
Yeah.
There are some common patterns that are emerging with some of the tool selection and so forth. And now with Docker Compose or Kubernetes, you know, I think we would love to see some turnkey, you know, turnkey stacks. And yeah, maybe it starts open source. A lot of these platforms have commercial implementations as well, but you know, just to streamline, you know, streamline getting started, just to, you know, essentially accelerate, you know, the adoption. Because like the truth is, like getting these components going takes so much time in enterprises. There's no value in it, right?
The
value comes when you're automating something with that platform. So we just want to be able to, you know, we want to be able to accelerate, you know, accelerate the time to value for you know, everybody out there.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time exploring different packages, projects, and so on. So I would agree to the point where the ones that actually have me stick around, have me interested in working on it further for the day, the week, and further on, were the ones that really focus on the first, like the onboarding experience, the first five minutes of launching your product, your project, and that kind of grabs your attention and brings value to you right away. Those are the projects that that really sticks around. And for projects that put emphasis on that, the payoff is great at the end. So that kind of ties back into what you were talking about, the whole stack, the decrease the time that are not bringing value, such as installing stuff, you know, getting the right configuration in, launching it, versus actually have it running so that it helps you to solve that problem. That 100% resonates with me for, you know, just kind of coincident, corresponds back to my experience of, you know, having these onboarding experience on these open projects, but you're talking about a grander scale, right? The whole stack, the whole experience, the multiple tools working together to solve that problem.
Yeah, exactly. And take one tool, talked a lot about it over the years, even Ansible, right? They wouldn't have been where they are if it wasn't just pip install, apt install, it is within minutes. It's my favorite demo to give, even in training, that just showcase, you know, within 5-15 minutes, you can have a fresh install and something brewing. And I really hope we can get there, you know, at this grander scale.
Yeah. That's your next clickbait blog. 5 minutes of automating your network.
That's it. That's it. 5 minutes of demo, 5 years to 5 years to get it going in the enterprise space.
All right. You know, you leave that second part out, otherwise you won't get anywhere. But Jason, I feel like we could talk forever, but you know, we're coming up an hour. You know, but I want to thank you for being on the call today. I know I learned a lot, and you know, it was kind of nice to reminiscent about the old years of the OpenFlag. I don't remember the last time somebody mentioned OpenStack or OpenDaylight to me. So it was nice.
We're getting old, right? We're getting up there now.
Oh, for sure, right? Like one day we'll be like, hey kids, gather around. Remember the time we used to dial up and 56K was was the bomb. But it's cool. So thanks again, Jason, for being on the show, for taking time.
Thanks, Eric. Really appreciate it.
Yep. So thank you for listening to the Network Automation Nerds podcast today. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all the other podcast platforms. Today, we talked to Jason Edelman, the founder and CEO, no longer CEO, but founder of Network to Code. So we had a good time. Until next time, bye-bye.